Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that always accurately calculates its divorce bill. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
In this episode, we discuss the speech everyone has been waiting for. No, not Donald Trump at the UN. We're talking about Rocket Woman Theresa May and her Brexit speech in Florence, the birthplace of the Renaissance. Will her concessions to the EU ensure Brexit Britain is a modern-day utopia? What's going on with Boris Johnson's Machiavellian intrigue? Surely he'd Dante have a chance of becoming Prime Minister. We'll be back after Steve has taken some Medici to recover from these puns.
They're so terrible.
So a foreign secretary writes an article in a broadsheet newspaper, interpreted as a thinly veiled leadership bid. Attacks and humiliation then follow. He backs down and the embattled, weakened Prime Minister goes on to fight another day. But enough about David Miliband's Guardian article in 2007. Let's talk about Theresa May's speech. Now, Theresa May's speech, Steve, it was apparently it was briefed as an opportunity to go over the heads of EU negotiators and go straight to the leaders of European countries. Mm-hmm. How many leaders of European countries were actually there in Florence to hear the speech?
Precisely zero. The audience was made up primarily of the British press.
The thing I don't understand is, I understand governments who say they are not going to negotiate with terrorists, but the May government position appears to be that we don't negotiate with negotiators.
Yeah, it is an interesting one. I think the problem is they are hitting roadblocks in the fact that Michel Barnier has basically orders from multiple places. He's got orders from the EU Commission, orders from EU heads of state, and orders from the European Parliament to a certain degree as well, although they do have a separate negotiator in the form of Guy Verhofstadt, the former Prime Minister of Belgium. He's got his marching orders, he's sticking with them, and he's basically saying we can't move on to talk about trade until we've dealt with the rights of EU citizens, the divorce bill, and, of course, the thorny issue of the border between Northern and the Republic of Ireland.
Mm. All of which Theresa May mentioned in her speech, and we'll talk about them in a second. I do think, though, it is a mistake to try and sideline Barnier, partly for the practical reasons that he's in the guy you're negotiating with. But also, Barnier wants to be EU Commission President when Jean-Claude Juncker steps down. And for that to happen, the Brexit talks need to be made a success of, to paraphrase our embattled Prime Minister. They can't fail. If they're seen to fail, then that's a black mark against him when the next commission elections are up. So actually, that's a good card we have in our hand. We should be relying on his goodwill, and that's just something we're not even trying to get.
No, and again, I think the problem here is that the government seems to be focused on the notion that the European Union is made up of the member states. And, you know, that is true. Angela Merkel, Emmanuel Macron, those leaders do have influence on the negotiations. The European Union is its own distinct body. The issue that the government is having is that they can't quite accept that, that they're having to deal with the EU and not those nation states. Because actually, if it was the nation states, it would probably be easier.
It would be familiar from anyone who watched the negotiations with Greece about their debt crisis going on. Varoufakis has written about this in his memoirs and a few other self-publicising speeches and interviews, that the EU is always looking for goodwill, and with Greece it's goodwill on structural adjustment programmes to try and adjust its government spending. With Britain, as you say, it's goodwill on divorce bill, EU citizens' rights. And talks won't move on until the EU is satisfied. And the EU knows that one of its main leverages is time. The EU has time to wait. Britain has no time to waste.
Yeah, it's something that the government has kind of fallen victim to. And this is why, actually, in many ways, the speech that Theresa May gave is actually quite significant, is that for the first time ever, they've accepted that Brexit might be a little bit complicated and actually come out and said, we actually need this transitional period. It's not as long as, you know, some people were saying it could be. I believe some people were briefing 5 years. We're down to two.
Now, of course, it's not a transitional period, though. It's an implementation period.
Of course, yes.
Only problem being we don't have anything to actually implement
yet.
But on that, the speech then? What's the content of the speech? What did she actually say?
The big kind of theme throughout most of the speech was about rebirth and a renaissance for Europe. Rebirth of Britain's relationship with Europe, rebirth of, in many ways, the European Union itself. Just a week or so ago, Juncker came out and started talking about further integration, the creation of an EU defence force.
EU cyborgs being produced in Luxembourg.
Well, I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords. But yeah, Juncker basically gave a speech saying, we want to be more integrated. This is the direction of travel that Europe's probably going to go in.
Classic federalist nonsense.
Yeah, again, once Britain's out of the picture, that was always going to be the way that Europe was going to move. So yeah, so in that sense, the speech kind of, to a degree, addressed the kind of the rebirth of the notion of what Europe is going to be as well. That theme of rebirth, kind of that the calling up of the Renaissance is quite interesting again, because May explicitly called out the Renaissance as almost being the peak of Europeanism. It's when Europe was at its most creative, innovative, when it was communal, working together, makes great strides for mankind and for Europe as a whole.
I would have chosen the Eurovision Song Contest myself.
So would I, but aside from the fact that displays a shocking lack of historical literacy, given that on Wikipedia there's an entire page entitled Italian Wars, just focused on the Renaissance period before you even get to all the other nations.
I can't wait for the rebirth of all the Protestant Catholic wars we're going to have over the next 20 years.
It's going to be amazing. Mind you, saying that, look at Northern Ireland.
It's too soon.
But that focus on Renaissance and that creativity and innovation and calling for the fact that we need this creativity as part of the Brexit negotiations. As I say, it's the first time, really, that the government seems to have displayed that this is going to be actually quite difficult, especially as what essentially has come out of this is that we're not going to be going for the European economic area, so we're not going for the Norway option, and we're not going to be going for the Canadian option area either, so we're not going to have a kind of just a free trade deal, quote unquote. We're going to go for something between the two, which, to be honest, makes a lot of sense. If we're not going to be a part of the EEA, which, given the EEA is bound by an awful lot by the rules and regulations, which are saying would be reduced because we wouldn't actually be a member of the EU, and the fact that an awful lot of the rhetoric around the Leave campaign was about sovereignty and taking back control, makes sense that we're not going to do that. But we also can't just be another free trade partner, because our position literally next door to Europe, as well as being integral to various counterintelligence operations, significant ways in terms of defence as well, military, diplomatic. Britain has a much closer relationship with Europe than America, China, Canada, Australia would ever have, just pretty much just due to geography. Which means, again, it makes sense why we're going down that route. But again, this is not a bespoke deal. This is something which is going to be very difficult to build out in the timeline as we've got. And again, that difficulty is why she's calling for creativity. And that creativity is why she set it in Florence. Because staging is a thing now, apparently, even though it didn't need to be there at all. I'd have been much more impressed if she'd given this speech in front of the European Parliament or the European Commission. But as the speech as it is, tonally, it's solid. It's a vast difference to the EU is trying to sabotage our general election that we had, literally months ago.
Turns out that was Nick Timothy.
Yeah, odd that. But yeah, so all in all, the speech did. It set out a couple of key things, reaffirmed a few bits and pieces as well. We aren't going to be a member of the EEA. We're not going to be a member of the single market. We're not going to be a member of the customs union. We knew this already, but given the back and forth, at least in the press, on a lot of these issues, that message doesn't seem to have gotten through to a lot of people. And so stating it again is actually quite useful and helpful for the government. And again, the main kind of takeaway really is that 2-year transitional agreement, or implementation period, as Theresa May termed it.
Mm. Now, the tone is definitely better. It's more positive. You talked about security earlier, and in the Lancaster House speech in November last year, Theresa May basically made a veiled threat, didn't she? And said, well, nice security arrangements we've got here. Be a shame if something happened to it. And this time, she explicitly said that security is something that we'd be working with the EU to solve. So that's good. I can't tell if it's too little, too late, I mean, Ian Dunst said we're about a year behind where we should be in terms of the rhetoric and the tone.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think it is too little too late. Any progress is progress in this instance. But I do think it is a case of, why did it take so long? Part of that, I think, boils down to the fact that, and this isn't down to Theresa May or even the current government, but the previous one under David Cameron and George Osborne, who just completely and utterly failed to do any preparation for the notion that maybe Britain might vote to leave the European Union.
Well, quite.
If so much of the kind of the groundwork and legwork that's been had to be done over the past year could have been done in the 6 months to a year previously, at which point we'd have been in a much stronger position to say, this is what happens.
And equally, Theresa May should have got this sorted out before she triggered Article 50.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Theresa May did massively shoot herself in the foot by triggering Article 50 for political expediency rather than the good of the nation. They were just desperate to get the issue dealt with simply because, well, they didn't want the right wingers and the press constantly going, when are you going to do it? When are you going to do it? When are you going to trigger it? You could have just said, we're going to do it in 2018 on this date after we've had a couple of years to prep properly, at which point we'll be gone by 2020. As long as we were out before the next general election at that point, we'd have been fine.
And I think the changing tone, and again, maybe we'll just talk about this before we go into the specifics of the speech, but I think that changing tone in that first year of the May premiership, anyone who expressed any doubts of how Brexit will be implemented or said, well, hang on, lads, we've got a few problems here, that was always seen as being a lack of goodwill and a wish by others in the what you could call deep state or Ramonas to try and sabotage Britain's leaving. So, for instance, Ian Rogers, who was the EU ambassador, was pushed out because he was quite sceptical of the government's approach. Everyone was stamping on any doubts that anyone expressed about how Brexit would be implemented. It was more about, it was their lack of bad faith. And so it's nice to see a changing tone. In terms of what the speech says then, EU citizens' rights, Theresa May says they'll still have the same rights essentially as now.
The key thing there was basically saying we don't think utilising the European Court of Justice as the guarantor of those rights is fair necessarily, and essentially that kind of would cut both ways as well, given that there's still going to be British people living in the EU and us making decisions in UK courts about the rights of citizens in other nation states that are completely separate to us, wouldn't be fair either. So I think in that regard, actually, the government's probably not too far off. I think there's been a lot of hot air blown about this and about the role of the ECJ. I think actually a second dispute mechanism is probably going to be needed across a number of different areas. So it would make sense for that to be the core decision maker anyway.
But again, the problem with EU citizens' rights is it's not even so much what Theresa May is saying, it's what her government is doing. And there have been lots of letters sent to EU citizens saying, you have no right to remain here, get out, you are deported, which have been sent incorrectly.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety on those EU citizens. Maybe we are saying nice things in speeches, but actually what the Home Office is doing is an entirely different matter, and it's hard to know if it's cock-up or conspiracy or...
It's cock-up. Like, the reality with the Home Office is just that it's understaffed, underfunded, and doesn't actually know what it's doing anymore. Like anything in life, it is more likely to be incompetence and cock-up than it is a vast conspiracy.
The divorce bill, Times Today says it was apparently briefed with £40 billion being the offer to the EU. I think in the speech, May says that Britain will pay what it's owed up to the end of the current EU budget cycle in 2020, which is £20 billion, so £20 billion. And so the £40 billion is an extra £20 billion on top of that. That's still on the low side when you see how some of the figures have been calculated. I've seen figures of £60 billion, £80 billion, even as high as £120 billion. Euros or 100, well, which is basically £120 billion now anyway.
Yeah.
So I suppose as a start of a negotiation about the divorce bill, it's a reasonable figure. Again, I think the big problem May will have is, what is the reaction of people in her party when the actual figure comes out?
Yeah, and again, this kind of comes back to one of the, I think, the core reasons this speech was given. As much as it's been billed as talking over Michel Barnier and talking to the heads of the EU 27 states, this was not a speech for them. This was a speech for the Tory party membership and for the Tory party MPs. This was a speech basically to try and put them at ease well, put both of the different wings of the Tory party on this issue at ease, to put the at ease the Remainers, the people who support the EU, that we aren't going to be walking over a cliff edge towards a hard Brexit. Effectively, 2 years more of continuity to give us a bit more time to actually try and resolve this, what our relationship will look like. But equally, job done potentially for the other side of the issue, for the Brexiteers, and that we're not going to be, we've reaffirmed that we're not going to be a part of the customs union, and we're not going to be a part of the single market.
And that transition period, as you say, an extra 2 years, which gives us essentially 3.5 years, which people would still argue is not quite enough time. We've talked about the Canada deal. I think that took 7 years to implement. So we're still behind where we should be. And it feels like, yes, we're trying to have our cake and eat it still. But we're also trying to have our cake and eat it when we don't have any skilled bakers.
Yeah, I mean, there is almost certainly an element to that. The key thing, actually, in terms of the timeline, is that whilst Theresa May outlined 2 years specifically as that kind of implementation period, the general gist of what she actually said was, we believe that we need to remain under the same kind of rules and systems and regulations for the sake of businesses not having to make multiple adaptions until we have got this new regulatory regime, this new relationship sorted. She said they think they can get that done in an extra 2 years, but what was actually said was, we will stick within this current regime until we've got that relationship done, which opens up potentially the possibility, at least, to that being extended further. Now, the key kind of thing there in terms of the internal politics of it is, how do you kind of make it look like you're not just bringing it, just extending it, which is obviously a genuine fear, seemingly, from Brexiters of all stripes. Theresa May did mention a couple of different aspects of, like, demonstrating that actually from the British side, we are going to look to bring in different ways of working as part of the system anyway. Theresa May mentioned, once we've got the dispute mechanism that's not the ECJ sorted, we'd look to utilise that as soon as we can so that any kind of issues can be resolved there moving forward. Again, kind of makes sense. You can't really fault that from the internal logic of the speech. And the other one was, whilst they said, yes, whilst we're in this transitional period, we will still allow new migrants from the EU to enter as part of, under the same rules and regulations of freedom of movement. The only difference is we'll need to register them, because at some point they are going to have to get registered, and it makes it easier for us if we do that. Those kind of relatively small changes, I suppose, are the sorts of things which I think that Theresa May is hoping will be viewed as signs of good faith from her towards the Tory right and the Brexiteers, as to that we're not just trying to sleepwalk into staying in the EU by a back door. The issue, however, is there. This is one area where EU intransigence could be a massive problem. Off the back of Theresa May's speech, Guy Verhofstadt, who we've mentioned previously, Verhofstadt's opinion does matter. Any deal does need to get through Parliament, especially in terms of this implementation period as well. The problem is, Verhofstadt's basically already come out and said, why would we let you do this? The terms of debate that we've agreed for Europe are that ECJ remains sovereign on EU citizens, and that freedom of movement is sacred. You know, you can't alter that, you can't change it. So if you want to stay in the EU, even if it's just partly part of this kind of transitional thing, you're going to have to obey by the same rules and regulations as you are now. And that means you can't register people. From my end, this is the sort of thing which I do think is actually quite dangerous from the EU, from our perspective of actually getting any deal. The EU can be intransigent, you know, quite difficult to work with just because of the nature of its bureaucracy. And I think what Verhofstadt's doing here is damaging, actually, to potentially damaging to Britain's future relationship with the EU, because he is just being a fundamentalist. The reality is, Britain is leaving. Does it make much of a difference, really, if people have to fill in that form when they get here? Probably not, because to be quite honest, most of them probably aren't going to be coming here anyway at the moment. So just sticking to your guns like that and just saying, no, we will not let this happen, which is, seems to be the gist of his comments so far, is not helpful.
Well, Verhofstadt is a federalist and, as you say, intransigent and inflexible, in the same way that Jean-Claude Juncker is as well. I think we've made reference to his speech to the EU Parliament a couple of weeks ago, saying that maybe we can try and have an EU army now. I think Remainers find that incredibly unhelpful. I mean, Theresa May puts the best spin on it, maybe from the British point of view, is, or from the EU, we've talked before about what can the EU get out of Brexit negotiating talks, and one of the things May said in the speech was, Britain won't stand in the way of the EU if it creates its army, which I suppose it's true, but it also makes it much harder to try and make any sort of case for a closer relationship or maybe somehow staying in the EU, which a lot of Remainers would like to do still. It's really hard to do that when you've got Jean-Claude Juncker going on about European armies, because no one wants that in Britain.
Yeah, Verhofstadt and Juncker, and even a certain large portion of the hardline Remainers, like AC Grayling, are completely out of touch with where Britain is as a country, not just in terms of the political organisation of the government or the policy, but in terms of like the feeling of your everyday individual. You know, I'm not against the notion of an EU army. Would I want Britain to be a part of that? Well, given that we're not necessarily, we've never been core EU in the same way as France or Germany is, we've always had very different views on foreign and military matters. Does that work, therefore, work in Britain's interests, quote unquote? Depending on where you sit on the kind of the ideological spectrum of foreign policy, your answer is probably going to be very, very different. But as a rule, we don't agree actually that with an awful lot of foreign policy decisions that are made in Europe, or rather, they don't agree with us. Which I think is the core differentiator there. So therefore, we would be hemmed in under those kind of circumstances. Now, rightly or wrongly, again, depends on where you sit on that ideological spectrum. But from a British perspective, that would not be a good thing. It would limit our ability to engage with the world diplomatically.
Just before we go on very, very quickly and talk about the politics of all this, May's ruled out joining the EEA. Did she in the speech rule out joining EFTA?
I don't believe it was specified.
So perhaps that could be a way. We keep saying that we want a bespoke deal, even though we don't really have the time or the
knowledge of what that looks like
to actually negotiate one. And EFTA would seem to be a good middle ground compromise that, again, a bit like being part of the EEA, would respect the result, not lead to an economic catastrophe. But I think if Britain was in EFTA, we would be able to strike trade deals, I think.
Not sure how EFTA relates to the customs union, so I could not say off the top of my head. Again, demonstrating that it's not a simple case of you can just walk away. There's an awful lot of options and an awful lot of change, which is about to be getting into very fine and granular detail.
Quite. So, politics of this. Transition deal is a big win for our very gothic Chancellor, Philip Hammond. Isn't it? He's been pushing for a transition deal in the interest of business for quite a while.
Yes, he has been. Although, interestingly, just before we started recording this, I noted that on the Guido Fawkes website, a quote had appeared from some unnamed Brexiter source, basically saying the Remainers had been outgunned and outmanoeuvred because originally there was going to be a 5-year transition period. Now there is only a 2-year period. Again, either it looks like, I'd still say if that's the case, Philip Hammond's still won because he's walked Theresa May back from that cliff edge, or at least extended out the cliff a little bit by hammering some wood onto the end of it, so that it takes her a little bit longer to get to the end of it. But it's clear that there's still going to be some arguments and that despite Boris and Philip Hammond coming out of the cabinet the other day all cheery and smiley, that there's still some grievances out there and they're still not necessarily 100% on board with the details. The broad general of direction of travel, I think, is agreed. We aren't going to be in the customs union. We're not going to be a part of the single market. But it's how do we get from where we are now to that?
In doing that, it feels a bit like David Davis is being sidelined a little bit because, again, there was a story this week about, I think, the permanent secretary of the exit in the EU department is now reporting to Theresa May.
He's basically been half-inched into number 10, actually, as an employee, rather than working for DexEU or whatever stupid acronym we're giving the department for exiting the European Union. Yeah, I think David Davis is being sidelined. I think Liam Fox has been sidelined. Not that he's got a job, actually, that does anything at the moment anyway, given that we can't strike free trade deals until we're out of the customs union anyway. Although, there was one interesting little tidbit, which I did find quite fascinating in Theresa May's speech, which I can easily see being the case given how the European Union works, which he basically said that even if we solved all the problems and came up with a trade deal tomorrow, the EU wouldn't legally be allowed to sign it until after we'd left, because we'd all, until that point, we'd still be a part of the customs union, which is just kind of insane when you think about it. That, I mean, granted, this is not something that's happened before. No one's tried to leave the EU, but it's odd that the EU couldn't legally cut a deal with us if they wanted to, if that's accurate. And given the way the customs union works or is focused, you could easily see how that might be the case.
I can't believe we're going to be talking about this for the next 5 years.
Oh, and the rest.
And the rest.
Like, Stephen Bush, again, who we mentioned quite a lot on this podcast, made a brilliant point the other day, which was, why do people think that this is just going to go away after 2019 or 2020 or 2020 whatever? NAFTA, the free trade agreement between North America, was signed 20 plus years ago and was a massive talking point in the US presidential election, as well as the Democratic primary between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. It's not going away, guys. As long as the EU are our biggest trading partner, we're going to be having these debates from now in perpetuity.
One thing that is going away is this episode.
Excellent segue there.
Thank you very much. We're going to stop there. We have another mini episode coming out on Monday on the McDonnell Amendment, in which, controversially, we're having alienated, basically spending the first year of our podcast alienating all the Jeremy Corbyn supporters. We're going to start alienating our core audience of Blairites by saying that all the Blairites should support the McDonnell Amendment. We are contrary. So there's that. Our theme tune is Pookie Good Times by Dave Depper. James Cram, who designs our logo, got in touch with us on Twitter to say that he wasn't available for Theresa May to design a logo. He only prefers to do for coherent, socially just enterprises like this podcast, apparently. But if you do want to get in touch with me on Twitter, you can tweet me at Paperback Writer.
And I'm at Centre Radical.
Happy plotting!